morning, ladies and gentlemen. We will hear argument in our only case of the day, United States against Scoyne. Mr. Lieberman.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Michael Lieberman from Federal Defender Services of Wisconsin, and it is my pleasure to be here today representing the appellant, Stephen Scoyne, as I have represented him at every stage of these proceedings. Your Honors, in District of Columbia versus Heller, the Supreme Court clarified that the Second Amendment to the United States Constitution guarantees a fundamental individual right. And I think it's important for all of us to start at that point because prior to Heller, I think we had all sort of gotten used to thinking that the Second Amendment wasn't quite as important as the rest of
the world. Well, no. The Supreme Court took the position that the states didn't have to follow the Second Amendment, that's all, up till then.
Up till then. And the cases that followed from that suggested the belief that the Second Amendment did not apply an individual protection, and it now does. It's now clear that it always has.
Up to a point.
Up to a point. That's correct.
And that's where I would like to start, Mr. Lieberman, because there's certainly no reason to think that this Court has anything but full respect for the Supreme Court's Heller decision. But when you say that the Second Amendment creates an individual right, it seems to me that that's the beginning of the conversation, not the end, because I take it you would agree, for example, that the Fourth Amendment also creates an individual right to be free from unreasonable searches and seizures.
Correct.
And yet there are many instances, this Court sees many of them, where the Fourth Amendment is simply not implicated. So when the police walk up on the street to somebody and say, we'd like to chat with you for a few minutes, that's conduct that's outside the scope of the Fourth Amendment, not within the scope, right? Okay. So isn't our question whether, as the Supreme Court has described the individual right in Heller, what conduct falls inside the scope or what package of rights fall inside the scope of the Second Amendment and what fall outside?
That's certainly the first question.
And an important question, because I take it, well, I'm not sure how far you want to go with this. Do you think, for example, that a 3-year-old child has a natural right to possess weapons?
No, I don't.
Why not?
I think it is certainly an easier case to, at the time of the founding, I think none of the rights were intended to apply to children.
Okay, so how about mentally insane people? Do they have a right protected by the Second Amendment to possess weapons?
Well, that is at least one of the specifics that the Supreme Court suggested.
But forget about it. Let's suppose that you agree that the Supreme Court's discussion there was nothing but dicta that we could just throw in the wastebasket. Tell me why you would say either that people with mental illness do have a right under the Second Amendment or why they don't.
My position would be that putting that language from Heller aside, that they do indeed have a right. The question then becomes, under what level of scrutiny does the court evaluate the infringement of that right, and is the law at question substantially related to that right,
So you think that everybody? Well, why doesn't the 3-year-old child have a right then? I mean, it seems to me you could do the same thing. You could say, well, the 3-year-old child has a right, but society perhaps has a strong reason to withhold that right.
Your Honor, perhaps Your Honor is correct about that. I think the line can get fuzzy when we talk about who has the right and how clear is it that the right can be infringed. I don't think anybody would disagree that the government has the authority to restrict a 3-year-old from
possessing
a gun.
Let me make this question more concrete in a different way. We're dealing here with a species of disability on conviction. And there are lots of civil disabilities that occur on conviction. One common one is that convicts lose the right to vote. Now, everybody has long agreed that the right to vote is an individual right. Nobody thought it was a collective right. But I don't think we would say that the states have to justify their disenfranchisement statutes under any particular level of scrutiny by having to prove to a trial judge that felons really shouldn't vote. My question for you is, why would the right to carry guns under the Second Amendment be treated differently for disability on conviction statutes than the right to vote?
Well, I guess my first answer, and not to be flip, is if it were treated the same, it would apply only to felons, so it wouldn't apply to Mr.
No,
Schoenig.
It would be a question of state law. Some states deprive misdemeanants of the right to vote. Some states don't. Actually, states differ with respect to felons. But I'm asking why, for the purpose of constitutional analysis, why for the purpose of analysis under the federal constitution, the right to carry firearms under the Second Amendment would be different from the right to vote under the 14th or the 15th.
I'm not sure it should be different. And just like with the right to vote, we don't restrict that right to misdemeanants, only to felons. And the case that we're here on now involves a misdemeanor.
No, counsel, the states differ on that dimension. But whether the states take a given person's right to vote away is similar to the question whether Congress has passed a statute taking away a given convict's right to carry firearms. I'm trying to figure out whether there's a constitutional difference. And I gather your answer is no. Well, if your answer is no, doesn't that pose a problem? Because I don't think courts say if there's a right depriving a given convict of the – if there's a statute depriving a given convict of the right to vote, that that statute is presumptively unconstitutional and it has to be defended in some empirical showing in a federal district court. That's what you're asking for. And if these are treated the same way, it's difficult to see how you get to that end.
To be completely honest, I'm not sure how I would answer the vote question.
If I read your brief correctly, you're making a very big thing out of difference between a misdemeanor and a felony. Am I correct in my analysis there?
Well, one reason...
Well, no. Are you making a distinction between a misdemeanor and a felony for this purpose?
We are, because the language in Heller... talks about longstanding prohibitions about felons.
If you think about this, the state and the federal have different definitions of what a felony is and what a misdemeanor is. And states vary from state to state on that same subject. Illinois, for instance, describes a misdemeanor as any case where you might be sentenced for less than a year and still go to jail. So reckless homicide, for instance, you can go to the penitentiary for 5 years. But under Illinois law, it's a misdemeanor. Under federal law, any case where you can go to the penitentiary is a felony. So that same case would be a felony in the federal system. Is there a distinction that you can see between a felony and misdemeanor and definition alone that makes it significant?
Your Honor, the basis on which we were drawing a distinction between felons and misdemeanors was in response to the government's argument that the language in Heller, which talks about the presumptive lawfulness of the longstanding prohibitions against the possession of firearms by felons, applies equally.
By federal definition, felon.
Well, and Mr. Schoenig would not be a felon under any definition.
Since there really is no good way to predict which domestic violence offenders be recidivists and which will. How do you think the government could more narrowly tailor this law?
I think 922 G8 is a perfect example of a more narrowly tailored law that addresses this concern. And G8 applies to those people for whom there is in existence a domestic violence restraining order. So that is somebody who at that current time a judge has determined that there is reason to believe that that individual is dangerous. When the restraining order expires, if it doesn't get renewed, so does the prohibition. And I would point out, Your Honor, in response to that, that
would this really help someone like Mr. Schoen, who is clearly a recidivist?
I mean, you place the restraining order, then you remove it, then he batters someone. You place the restraining order. Here he is again. He's battering someone.
Well, there's never been a restraining order placed against Mr.
No, I understand that, but I'm asking if that would be helpful for someone like him, is a real recidivist.
Well, it would at least make clear the times during which he's deemed to be dangerous and can't possess a gun.
But I have a broader question about this. I think it really picks up a little bit on what Judge Bauer was talking about and perhaps some of Chief Judge Easterbrook's comments. We're dealing here with a federal statute, and Congress has identified a number of classes of people. There are 9 subparts of Part G who are not permitted to have firearms. And the first one is felons. We have fugitives from justice. We've got controlled substance addicts. We've got all kinds of people. And Congress has added to that those who have been convicted of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence, which in turn becomes a defined term. There have to be certain procedural safeguards. The crime has to have an element. So Congress has carefully described this set of people, and in that sense, for this set of people, has created a uniform federal rule. It's saying we're not worrying about whether this happens to be a state where this is handled as a misdemeanor. We're not worrying about whether this happens to be a state where it's handled as a felony. This kind of person is to be disabled from having a firearm. Why isn't that easily within Congress's power, particularly actually in light of even the recent decision of the Supreme Court in the Comstock case, which gave a very generous reading to Congress's power to define different conditions that happened to be post-conviction, as you know, or post-sentence detention. But this is a federal statute, and I think your concern about what the state has done is maybe not entirely the right question to be asking.
Well, Your Honor, with all respect, I think as the Supreme Court said in Logan, which was another case that started before this court, and the issue there was about the rights restored and whether if a state doesn't take your rights away, can they ever be restored under Section 921A20. And the issue there is that Congress has decided to trust the states. If the state believes that somebody is again worthy of having their guns back, having their rights back, if the rights have been removed and then the state decides it's now okay to give them back, that that's a choice that the federal government should respect.
But as you're rightly saying, sometimes Congress chooses to incorporate state law fully, sometimes Congress chooses not to incorporate it at all under some of the subparts of G, and sometimes maybe we're in intermediate position. So what Congress has done is it's carved out a subset of misdemeanor crimes of domestic violence and has said those people are among those who are not permitted to have a firearm.
But it hasn't uniformly carved out that exception because under 921A33, it still says you can if you're convicted of a misdemeanor and it's a state that removes your rights based on a misdemeanor conviction and the state gives it back to you, then you can again possess a gun.
You're not complaining about that, and that's really not before us at all, I don't think.
But it does show that it's not Congress uniformly accepting state law, because in a state like Wisconsin, Mr. Skoyan's rights were never taken away.
To change the subject slightly, I think your concession about subsection 8 is extremely damaging to your position, because subsection 8 just requires a predictive finding, right? But subsection 9 actually requires that the person has the physical safety of the person. We usually think that a conviction is much better evidence of the dangerousness of a person than a finding. So under 8, you can be deprived of your right to have a gun, even though you've never done anything, right? You haven't done anything.
But Your Honor,
you frightened someone, and a judge has said, yeah, you're a credible threat, which is just predictive. And in 9, you've actually been convicted of this domestic violence. So that looks like an a fortiori case for removing the right to have a gun.
Well, I've got a couple answers to that, if I could, Your Honor. First, I don't think I conceded, certainly didn't intend to concede.
You spoke with enthusiasm of subsection.
Well, it was in response to Judge
Whatever
Grover.
It was in response to, you said 8 was fine. Yeah, you can withdraw that and say 8 is unconstitutional
what I said
also.
Was that was a
well,
more
you think
narrowly
eight, you think
tailored,
8 is unconstitutional
I
also?
I said that was a more narrowly
No, it isn't more
standard.
Narrow because all it requires is a prediction that someone might endanger a wife or child, right? Whereas 9 requires a conviction this person has in fact committed criminal violence.
And we can disagree whether it's more narrowly tailored or not.
No, we can't disagree because it's not more narrowly tailored. What's more? Look, under 8, a finding of such person represents a credible threat to the physical safety. Someone who's been convicted of domestic violence is not merely a credible threat. This person has already compromised the physical safety of that person.
It may have been 20 years ago. That was the point I was trying to make. G8 is more limited in time. Therefore, I think more narrowly tailored, in my view. G9 is a permanent, lifetime, perpetual ban to ever possess a gun for any reason.
I don't understand that, counsel, the permanent lifetime. Section 921.33b, Romanet 2, expressly sets out conditions under which that ban is lifted, including pardon, expungement, you know, relief of civil disabilities. There are plenty of ways to get one's opportunity to carry a gun back. If the governor pardoned your client, there wouldn't be any problem.
Well, Your Honor, the relief of civil disabilities, again, only applies in states where those disabilities...
That particular clause, one of the points of the Supreme Court's holding in Logan is that that's just one of the three ways to get your rights back. Another is pardon. So if you go to the governor and persuade the governor to pardon your client can carry a gun. In fact, so far as I could see, the governor could pardon the firearms disability out of a conviction. But it seems to me just unwarranted, given the language of the statute, to say that this is permanent lifetime. It's permanent only if none of the three ways to get the rights back occurs.
Well, if it's an expungement, essentially that means the conviction doesn't exist anymore. So that's simply saying you're not guilty of the new offense anymore. Because the elements don't exist.
Well, we're not supposed to just weigh the likelihood that these things are going to happen, right? It's the fact that the possibility is there. It's in the statute. You could get the expungement. You could get pardon. But we don't have to weigh what the odds are that this will happen. And that shouldn't be part of our consideration.
I think if we get to the standard of scrutiny, if we're looking at the fit between the statute and the compelling government interest, if there is one, I think the court does have to look at the likelihood that those things will happen.
Well, how is that different from 8? So you're subject to a court order. So is it your view that those court orders have deadlines in them?
They do.
They expire after 2 weeks or something?
They do.
What makes you say that?
That's the restraining orders are temporary. They're not permanent restraining orders. They
have an end date. Depends on the order, doesn't it? I mean, sometimes they last for quite a while because the threat continues for quite a while.
Right. But
you understand, we don't have domestic relations in the federal system, so there are those of us who are unfamiliar with the skeety.
I will try harder to explain that. But
some of us have been there. So,
you know. Even in the situation where it does extend for a longer period of time, that is based on a finding, based on evidence
But wait. What do these orders say? Do they come with a deadline? Is there some rule that you have to renew it every week or something, or what?
It depends on the jurisdiction.
Well, does a judge in Wisconsin have the power to simply issue this order, this Section 8 order, without a deadline in it?
I believe the answer to that is no.
Can you provide evidence for that, or that's just your hunch, or what?
I don't have evidence.
That's in Wisconsin law? Is it a Wisconsin statute that limits the duration of these orders? Is that what you're saying?
I believe it is, and I would be happy to provide that in a Rule 28J letter.
Well, that's okay.
I was really fascinated by your report at page 47 of your brief, because I wondered if you really believe that we're meant to be reassured that only 48% of offenders suspended violence 3 years after the first reported incident of domestic violence. In other words, do we say to a woman, look, don't worry about your husband or partner's violence.
It could be a man, too, you know.
And the gun under his only in your case. Under
I should have known better than to train Switzerland. The fact is, I didn't know you were ever threatened either.
Under his pillow, there's only a 52% chance that he'll still be beating you in 3 years. I mean, what is this likelihood all about?
Well, you know, I think both sides offered statistics that don't necessarily get to the ultimate point. Even if G9 stands, it doesn't prevent future acts of domestic violence. It simply tries to get a gun away from somebody. I would submit that the only study cited in either brief that really gets to that question is the one that we cited by Professor Vigdor from Duke, which looked at jurisdictions, states that passed a statute like G9 and tracked domestic homicides prior to the passage of that statute and after the passage of that statute, and found no evidence of any reduction in those incidents after passage of the statute.
Well, do you want to talk about U.S. versus Hayes and what it tells us about the Supreme Court's view of whether 922 G9 lessens the risk of harm from domestic violence?
It certainly addresses that point. I don't think that was the issue of the Hayes case. The issue there was a statutory interpretation question, and they answered that question.
Is the violence described could be physical with fists, it could be with a knife, it could be with a firearm? Are the statistics broken out that way?
The Vigdor study that I referred to only talks about homicides.
Doesn't make any difference how the homicide was committed in that study.
Correct.
Isn't that an awfully narrow focus, given the fact that guns can be used both for personal injury short of homicide, and they can also be used as a tool of intimidation? Seems to me, if you're just looking at murders, you really have defined away a great deal of the problem Congress was after, at least according to Hayes.
And, Your Honor, in response to that question, I would refer to the court to the Journal of the American Medical Association study that the government cites in its brief, and at page 3046 of that study, the author there says, and I'll quote it directly because I think it's important, in this study, we found that the presence of a firearm lowered the risk of non-fatal injury relative to other weapons. So I think if you read those two studies together, what you have is there's no evidence that it reduces homicides, and there is evidence that it does reduce non-fatal injuries.
The so four shots? I mean, they can't aim? Or what? I don't understand that.
But he just blows him away.
But that's the evidence that's here. Those are the studies that have been presented to the court.
If I understand your position, Mr. Lieberman, Mr. Skoyan has a right to keep a firearm for self-defense if he wishes. Is that right? There are instances, certainly many of them, in which both spouses might have misdemeanor convictions for domestic violence. Is each one entitled to keep a firearm for self-defense against the other?
Under the pillow.
I don't think the Constitution speaks to where they have to keep the firearm.
So let me ask you just the felon in possession ban, do you think that's constitutional?
I think that's a closer question.
Well, the reason is because G9 covers criminals with a domestic violence conviction. So the case for banning firearms under this scenario is much stronger, don't you agree, than the felon in possession ban, which that applies to white-collar criminals.
I don't agree with that, Your Honor. I think historically, for better or worse, we have treated felons different than we've treated misdemeanors. There are disabilities that have applied to felony convictions that just don't apply to
misdemeanors. So you think that's constitutional to say that a tax evader can have a gun because he had a felony tax evasion, but a domestic batterer can have a gun? I think that's a rational distinction based on history.
I think historically we have treated those.
But you think it's rational?
I do.
Why do you think it's rational?
Because based on history, at the time of the Second Amendment, there was not question as to whether felons could be barred. That's the way the country has evolved. Misdemeanants were not. At the time the Second Amendment was ratified, it was not intended, in our view, to apply to misdemeanors.
But we're not talking about all misdemeanants. There are many misdemeanors, shoplifters, disorderly conduct people, first-time driving while intoxicated people. There are all manner of misdemeanants who are not under this statute. Don't you think this court needs to take a fairly narrowly tailored approach to this case?
Well, certainly, this case applies to domestic violence misdemeanors.
What was domestic violence in 1789? Was it a misdemeanor or a felony?
I don't think it was illegal.
Oh, you don't think it was illegal?
It wasn't.
Oh, my goodness.
You could hit her with anything big, swish, any bigger than your thumb. That was the question.
Your Honors, I do see that I'm into my rebuttal time, so if I could reserve a little bit of that time. Thank you.
Certainly, counsel. Mr. Dreeben.
Judge Easterbrook, and may it please the court. The government submits that 18 U.S.C. 922 G9 is constitutional and can be upheld on the basis of the reasoning in the Heller opinion. If this court undertakes an independent examination of the scope of the Second Amendment, it is our view that the right that was embodied in the Second Amendment does not protect violent criminals, persons who have demonstrated a propensity for violence. And therefore, the category that's covered by 922 G9 is outside the scope of the Second Amendment. And if this court should reach the question of whether 922 G9 needs to be examined under a standard of review, it's our submission that the appropriate test would be an intermediate scrutiny test that takes into account the character of the right and the character of the government's interest. And in this case, we'd give substantial deference to Congress's predictive judgment that the presence of a gun in the hands of someone who has been convicted of a violent misdemeanor against intimate members of his family poses a sufficient threat, and that taking the gun away sufficiently alleviates the threat to justify the law if it is subjected to a standard of review. Now, the initial question is, what does Heller mean when Heller spoke of presumptively constitutional laws such as the laws that dispossess of arms felons, the mentally ill, that protect laws that deal with the presence of guns in sensitive places, and that deal with commercial regulation of firearms? In our view, the court sent a clear signal to the lower courts that longstanding prohibitions of that character are valid because they do not infringe the right that was intended to be protected by the Second Amendment in the first place.
So suppose Congress had added a subpart 10 to this statute that said all shoplifters are dispossessed of the right to have a weapon. Is there some stage in your analytical structure where you look at the category Congress has defined for that very first step to ask whether this is within or outside the scope of the Second Amendment?
I think so, Judge Wood. I mean, clearly, if Congress attempted to disarm all people who had overtime parking tickets, I think it would push the line beyond what the framing era understanding was of the kind of criminal who posed a threat to public safety and could therefore be disarmed. Shoplifting is somewhat of a closer case because, as I'm sure the court knows under the sentencing guidelines, shoplifting is sometimes treated as a crime of violence because taking something from the person of another does potentially trigger a violent reaction. And therefore, that would be a categorization question that the court would have to address. Congress in 922 G9, I think as Your Honor indicated, selected categories of individuals where there is some specific reason to believe that the presence of firearms in their hands would pose a danger to society. And of these, 922 G9 is in some ways the tightest fit with that rationale. It requires an actual conviction of a crime of violence, not merely a restraining order that's issued by a judge in order to forestall the possibility of violence, and not just a felony of any character whatsoever, which could include securities fraud, tax evasion, perjury, and other crimes that are not necessarily associated with a threat of violence. This law is targeted at someone who has individually been found to have engaged in the kind of violent act that's covered by the scope of the statute, and has done so in a domestic context.
So, but what about the fact that this intriguing list in Heller speaks of felonies? And if the state doesn't think that the domestic violence, I mean, I'm sure there's some forms of domestic violence in states that would certainly be prosecuted as felonies, and we don't need to worry about those because they're under subpart one. But Heller doesn't use the word misdemeanor. I know it has the little catch-all at the end that says we're not being exhaustive. But what do we do about that?
Well, Judge Wood, I think that the catch-all is the critical feature here because in giving the list that it did, the court was careful not to call into question other forms of regulation that I think would logically and historically be viewed similar in character. Now, it's an apparent finding of the historians, which we don't question, that at the time of the founding, there weren't laws that specifically dispossessed felons of firearms because of their convictions. Felons, of course, suffered a form of civil death and were often required to forfeit their property, and as a result may well have lost firearms in that process, assuming that they weren't executed upon.
Yeah, I was going to say, I thought felons at the time of the founding suffered more than a metaphysical
oftentimes
death.
Oftentimes they had the benefit of clergy and other mechanisms of alleviating the harshness of the law, but felons do, I think, stand in a different category. But some of the best evidence that I think the court can use to understand what was the nature of this pre-existing right, which was incorporated into the Second Amendment, is the reaction of the anti-federalists to the original Constitution, which did not include a Bill of Rights and therefore didn't protect any of the individual rights that we now recognize. The Pennsylvania minority proposal brought forward by the anti-federalists did propose a right to arms which could only be divested upon crimes committed or real danger to public injury posed by individuals. And I think that is perhaps the best snapshot of the accumulated historical understanding of what the right to arms meant.
Well, counsel, that qualifier, of course, did not find its way into the Second Amendment.
It did not, Judge Sykes, but at the same time, the court made clear that the right that's embodied in the Second Amendment reflected a pre-existing right, which is, of course, subject to pre-existing exceptions. The First Amendment, for example, has no exceptions in its terms for obscenity, for defamation, for words that are used that are integral to the commission of a crime. And Heller itself recognized that those historical exceptions to the scope of the amendment are just as much part of the right.
But were the exceptions historically categorical and perpetual, or were they more limited in nature? You know?
Yes, I understand the question, and I think it's difficult to answer with specificity.
Right, and where it's difficult to answer and where the historical evidence is inconclusive, the tie generally goes to the challenger of the law.
Not in this case, I don't think, because the nature of the right has to be understood against the background of a number of different limitations that had been placed on that right, both in England, where the right originated, as the Supreme Court recognized, and in the colonies. And when one looks at the cumulative sum of those rights, what I think the conclusion is that emerges is that those people who respected gun rights understood that guns are valuable for self-defense, they're valuable for offensive purposes in a militia, they are just as dangerous when placed in the hands of people who do not use them responsibly. And so a variety of regulations were imposed against irresponsible use of firearms, which led to the understanding not only in the Pennsylvania Anti-Federalist proposal, but in Samuel Adams, who was one of the foremost champions of gun rights, who proposed a similar amendment that said that the right of firearms shall not be infringed when held by peaceable citizens. So I think that there is a sort of understanding about the nature of the law-abiding responsible citizen, to use Heller's words, who enjoyed firearms rights. And that understanding is not so limited by the common law in the way for perhaps the Seventh Amendment is supposed to track the common law. It represents an essential value judgment that's embodied in the Second Amendment. And just as with other amendments that are given their force in light of the value judgments of the framers by a process of estimation of how the framers would apply it to laws today, so too the Second Amendment should be read. For example, in Crawford versus Washington, where the court tracked the Confrontation Clause right to the right of confrontation that was understood by the framers, it responded to an argument made by the dissent that the framers only applied the confrontation right to statements under oath by saying, we don't agree with that, but even if that were true, we would then have to ask the question, how would the framers have applied that insight to the attempt by the prosecution to introduce statements not under oath? And even if the court said we can't make that estimation exactly because we lack the historical materials to do it, we should make it as accurately as we can. And similarly, in Kylo versus United States, where the court applied the Fourth Amendment to thermal imaging, which the framers would have had no way of contemplating because that form of technology didn't exist. That is, I think, the way that constitutional rights and their historic exceptions may exist. I don't think that the court, for example, has said the law of defamation has to track in the states precisely some historical analog that can be traced to a colonial law. And so, too, with the Second Amendment. We're dealing here with a law that targets a problem that Congress had identified as a loophole in the pre-existing felon disarmament provision.
Do you agree that there's a variety of definitions of felonies depending on the state you're in?
Of course.
How do we understand what felony means then in Heller?
I think that the court used the phrase without elaboration. If this court were inclined to provide a single definition for it, it would have two choices, I think. One would be however a state labels a crime, which seems to me a somewhat unsatisfying way to approach a question of understanding the Supreme Court's decisions because, as been noted earlier, states label crimes quite differently even though they prohibit the same conduct and prescribe similar punishments. The other way to look at it, I think, was as essentially a metaphor for a serious crime, which would explain Judge Wood's hypothetical about crimes that might not be serious enough to place one outside the scope of the Second Amendment.
General Dreeben, is it your position that when you speak of Congress trying to correct an omission, is the omission that Congress is trying to correct that domestic battery has been historically undercharged?
That was one of the things that senators on the floor who supported 922G9 said.
And what should we make of a congressional intent to improve the prosecutorial discretion of individual states as a policy matter?
I'm not sure that what Congress was attempting to do was improve prosecutorial discretion.
Or they're trying to impact it some way.
I think that what Congress was doing was enacting a law that followed on the heels of the 1994 enactment of the Violence Against Women Act, in which Congress had voluminous evidence that women in the criminal justice system were often not given a fair shake, either because of historical assumptions about the lower value and less importance of that crime. And it wasn't limited to prosecutors. It also included I'm sorry to say, judges
and police officers.
Well,
let's speak of the criminal justice system generally. If the evil is that domestic abuse is not treated appropriately in the criminal justice system, either in the charging or the sentencing, so that's a policy concern we should recognize that Congress appropriately can impact by this kind of legislation.
Well, I think so, but this law is not limited to instances in which the conduct was felonious and only charged as a misdemeanor. I'm not sure that appellant's conduct here was chargeable as a felony under Wisconsin law, but it was the kind of conduct that Congress deemed to be a sufficient predictor of risk of repetitive violence, either against an intimate partner, which Congress had ample evidence to believe was a recurring kind of crime that tended to escalate, or perhaps against a police officer who's called out to the scene of a domestic violence episode. It's one of the most common situations in which police officers are injured or killed. Domestic violence is a powder keg. And even when it's a misdemeanor conviction, what it reflects is that an individual who's really dealing with the people who he should most love and cherish, his children or his wife or his intimate partners, has exploded to the degree that merited a criminal conviction. And I think even today, even in the most enlightened of jurisdictions, most domestic violence instances are not going to result in a criminal prosecution. They tend to when it's the most severe. Even when it is severe, they often aren't prosecutable successfully as felonies because victims frequently do not appear. The Supreme Court's Crawford decision has made it more difficult to get the evidence in. There sometimes is two-way violence, which is unappealing to a jury. But Congress was permitted to take into account all of those things in placing itself, aligning itself with a historical tradition that said those people who have committed crimes found beyond a reasonable doubt and are real dangerous to public injury, to use again the words of the Pennsylvania Anti-Federalist proposal, are the kind of people who, in their hands, guns can prove disastrous.
I don't think, counsel, that you're going to get a whole lot of disagreement about the seriousness of the problem that Congress was trying to address here or the strength of the governmental interest. The real question is the scope of this law and its perpetual nature and its exceptionless nature. There's no way for the domestic violence misdemeanant after the expiration of any period of time to recover those rights except by the vehicle of the pardon power, and I don't think that governors pardon domestic violence misdemeanants with any regularity. And the expungement remedy has to be ordered at the time of sentencing, and in my experience as a state court judge for many years hearing these cases, that just doesn't happen very often. And so for practical purposes, this is a perpetual lifetime ban that cannot be lifted. And that's the difficulty with this statute, not that the government's interest isn't very strong or that there's not enough empirical evidence to demonstrate that, but that there isn't the fit that's required even under the intermediate scrutiny that you're advocating for.
Judge Sykes, I have two basic responses to that. The first is that in analyzing the scope of the Second Amendment right, our view is that by committing a crime of violence in this context, the defendant has really forfeited his Second Amendment right. He stands outside of the Second Amendment, and the court doesn't need to engage in a tailoring analysis in order to uphold it.
Right. That's your historical scope argument here. But as I've already observed, I think there's some difficulty with that as a historical matter because of a problem in getting it nailed down as a historical matter with any kind of certainty that domestic violence misdemeanors or misdemeanors in general fell outside the scope of the right. We're just not going to be able to find a historical answer to that question with any assuredness. And so we do get into the justification argument if the scope argument fails. And that's what my question went to.
And I just wanted to be clear on what the hierarchy is of my responses to that question. On the tailoring question, we may have a different view of how closely a statute needs to be tailored given Congress's compelling interest and the individualized finding of violence. I would certainly agree that there is a greater amount of attenuation, to be sure, if somebody were 50 years out from their conviction and had lived a blameless life with no recurrence of violence. But it's very difficult to predict who will fit into that category. And I think that in this area, as the Supreme Court said in the Turner Broadcasting case, when predictive judgments are extraordinarily difficult, empirical evidence is hard to come by, Congress gets deference in the decisions that it makes. As your opinion for the panel recognized, in intermediate scrutiny, laws can be overbroad. It's not necessary that they be the least restrictive alternative. And I think the tailoring here is really supplied
There's
by
something
the...
odd when you say should be deference to Congress's judgment, because Congress, when it passed 922, it didn't know that there was a constitutional right to have a gun, right?
I agree with that.
So it wasn't balancing that right against public safety concerns.
Correct. That
so this isn't really a responsible congressional judgment, right? Because they didn't balance because they didn't know there was something in the other pan.
Correct. And I'm not asking this court to defer to Congress's balance of Second Amendment rights. I was speaking specifically of the judgment that it made that...
Yeah, but they made the judgment in a kind of vacuum, right? Because they didn't think there was anything on the other side. They just thought, well, you know, there's danger, maybe a slight danger, but it doesn't matter. No one has a right to have a gun anyway, so we might as well take it away from these people.
Not the way that it was articulated by the senators who spoke to it, who were more concerned about the long-range risks of violence. And admittedly, there were no studies before Congress.
It's a question of studies. It's a question of would congressmen deliberate in a different way once they learned that they were curtailing or, you know, balancing against, well, curtailing a constitutional right.
Judge Posner, one of the assumptions that underpins that question is that you've rejected our scope argument, because to the extent that Congress could legitimately read the Heller opinion, project itself backwards to 922 G9's enactment, and conclude that people who commit serious crimes or pose a danger to the public order are not within the scope of the Second Amendment, it would have had no reason to calibrate the constitutional calculus any differently than it did. But I think that this court's task is still the same, even if it concluded that congressmen or individual congressmen would look at the problem anew in light of the Heller decision. The court's task is still to decide, does this claimed right fit within the scope of the Second Amendment? If it does, what's the applicable standard of scrutiny, and does it pass it? I think in many respects the panel opinion, when it was speaking of the standard of scrutiny, was correct. And I agree that an intermediate standard of scrutiny has the necessary flexibility to accommodate the different kinds of interests and rights that may be asserted with respect to the Second Amendment. And in that context, the Supreme Court has given guidance that deference to the empirical predictive judgments that Congress makes in the absence of evidence that's going to be very conclusive to a judicial mind is appropriate. I think it's appropriate here to uphold the law in addition, because the interest is not merely important, as has been required for an intermediate scrutiny analysis to uphold a law. It's a compelling interest, and it's one that deals with a right that is different in nature from any of the rights that the Supreme Court has really previously examined under heightened scrutiny. As I said before, I believe, guns, which are valuable for self-defense, are for the same reasons very threatening when placed in the hands of people who are dangerous with them. And whether the court buys the argument that violent individuals are outside of the scope of the amendment, surely a specific indication of violence evidenced by a conviction is a powerful fact that should detract from the constitutional rights that the defendant asserts and the concomitant level of scrutiny that a court applies in order to determine whether it's valid. And I did want to return to the question of whether the means of regaining rights under the statute are adequate. Congress made a reasonable judgment that deferring to the various processes that the states have to determine whether a person can be safely trusted with firearms is a reasonably tailored approach.
Can I ask you a question about that? Suppose, I mean, one of the problems has been that misdemeanors may not result in the loss of civil rights, including gun rights, and thus there's nothing to be restored. So that argument is made. Do you think Wisconsin tomorrow could pass a statute that says anyone who's convicted of a misdemeanor crime of domestic violence will have his civil rights removed so that they can then later be restored after, say, 5 years of good behavior or something like that?
I think that Wisconsin could pass laws that did provide for, in the words of the statute, the set-aside or expungement of a conviction. And the circuit courts that have looked at this, most notably a Tenth Circuit case involving a state law passed by Wyoming, have made clear that the set-aside of the conviction has to be complete. If the state concludes that this individual shall no longer be treated as a convict, then it fits within the category of expungement in the federal law.
Wouldn't have a problem with such a law being passed tomorrow, even though Mr. Skoyan's convictions are well into the past. Could he take advantage of such a new law, or would there be a problem?
No, I don't think it'll help him on this case, because he was a misdemeanant convict at the time of his criminal behavior in this case. He was actually under probation at the time. He had signed a piece of paper that said, I understand that I'm not to possess firearms. But if Wisconsin or some other state wanted to provide prospectively a means for setting aside convictions, I don't think that there's anything in federal law that prevents it. It was Congress's judgment that if the state deems the individual safe enough to regain civil rights, not to be viewed as somebody with the conviction, then federal law would accept that conclusion. It has to go all the way, of course. If the state restricts the individual's firearm rights, or it gives him back only his firearm rights and otherwise preserves its ability to use the conviction for recidivism purposes, then it doesn't count under the federal understanding of what is a set-aside or an expungement of a conviction.
Right, but the states don't take away gun rights or any other civil rights of misdemeanants.
They don't, but they...
So you're asking the states to adopt a law that says the status quo is what it is.
I think a law that was sort of transparently aimed at just saying your rights are taken away and now we give them back would be a little problematic. But a law that said we have decided as a policy matter that misdemeanants who have lived 5 years with a blameless life can apply to a court and upon a showing that they pose no threat to the public interest may have their convictions sealed and set aside. There are states that have such laws. Nevada has one. California has one. And individuals who satisfy those requirements will be lifted from the 922 G9 ban. And in that sense, this law is not perpetual with no exceptions whatsoever, but it does depend on action by the convicting jurisdiction to provide that mechanism. And that's the safety valve that Congress had in mind. I don't think that it had to have any more finely tuned federal mechanism in mind. I mean, if one imagines, would a statute be more narrowly tailored if it said after 10 years you regain your gun rights, or after 20, or after 30? I think it would be very difficult for...
I'm having trouble with this argument. I mean, this is an argument that the scope of and the applicability of federal constitutional rights, enumerated constitutional rights that have been so declared by the United States Supreme Court, are a matter of the legislative grace of 50 state legislatures. That doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, I think what makes sense is for Congress to say, if individuals are to be given their firearms rights back by virtue of having a conviction erased, it's appropriate to defer to the jurisdiction that imposed the conviction to decide that the individual is now safe enough to regain gun rights. I don't disagree that Congress could have created a federal bureaucracy with 100,000 administrative law judges to adjudicate petitions for remissions of firearm rights. In fact, in Section 924 5 of Title 18, Congress did contemplate that ATF would have a mechanism for restoring firearms rights. It hasn't funded that mechanism, and it's in essence said we don't want there to be a federal bureaucracy making those decisions, and one can only imagine the outcry if there were.
Right. This whole discussion just illustrates how extraordinarily limited the escape hatch in Section 922 is, and so that it should not have much bearing on the analysis here about whether this law is over-inclusive as a matter of Second Amendment jurisprudence.
The last thing I think I would say on that, Judge Sykes, is even if one were concerned about that, the appellant here seems an extraordinarily poor candidate to be raising that claim. He was on probation at the time of his offense. His conviction occurred 2 years before. It was his second conviction.
Let's say it was 10 years ago, and he was clean.
Well, then that defendant would have, perhaps in Your Honor's mind, a more appealing claim than this one.
This isn't just about me.
No. I'm responding to your questions.
Okay.
They're valid questions that should be raised and thought about. Just to be clear on it, our position is that Congress could disarm perpetually, even if the court regarded there as being no safety valves whatsoever for this class of individuals. Congress would have latitude to conclude that the reasonable prediction of violence resulting from someone who has this kind of conviction is sufficient to place the burden on the safety of the intimate partners with which this person lives and police officers who may respond to further crimes, and not to restore firearm rights. To the extent that the law, however, provides mechanisms for restoration, however narrow, we think that's sufficient to answer any constitutional tailoring concern, and this is all assuming that violent individuals who have been convicted of crimes are within the scope. So on numerous levels, I don't think that the law would be invalid even if we were dealing here with someone who were 10 years out, 20 years out, 30 years out with a clean record and no mechanism in his state to have that recognized. But even if the court thinks that that's wrong, this would not be the case appropriately to say it. What I think the court should do is uphold Section 922 G9 as constitutional in light of Heller's reasoning, the historical basis for the exceptions in the Second Amendment that pertain to violent individuals, and the record, which is compiled in our brief and in the amicus brief for the Brady Center, showing that to answer the empirical questions that were raised by the panel's opinion, domestic violence is indeed a problem affected with great recidivism, and that removing guns from the presence of the house does reduce the risk of a violent event occurring in the house.
Thank you, Mr. Draven.
Thank you, Chief Judge Easterbrook.
Anything further, Mr. Lieberman?
Very quickly, Your Honor. I think the one point I want to respond to is the argument about deferring to the judgment of Congress on this. I think we set out, both in our brief and in our reply brief, the paucity of evidence in the congressional record of anything that Congress actually considered before passing this statute at the 11th hour as part of an appropriations bill. So there were no hearings. There were no studies. Not only was Congress not making its judgments with an understanding that the Second Amendment applied, it was also making those judgments based on no real empirical.
Some of us think that the best evidence of Congress's intent is the actual statute that it passed, not necessarily how much in the way of hearings or committee reports or chatting on the floor they came up with. We do know that Congress passed the statute.
Certainly, and by recognizing that the Second Amendment is now a fundamental individual right, that does take certain policy choices off the table for Congress.
Well, what would, in your view, be a permissible revision of subsection 9?
I think certainly doing some, if Congress were to study over what period of time the danger is the most.
Give me a better answer. What would you regard, at least tentatively, as an appropriate revision of 9?
I would suggest a revision of 9 that includes, at a minimum, some reasonable time period I am not, based on the evidence that we've seen so far in this case, I'm not prepared to say what that time period should be.
Wouldn't it have to be a little longer than 2 years?
I don't know. It depends on what the empirical evidence showed.
Could I ask about one of the things that troubles me, Mr. Lieberman, is that it seems to me that your view, your reasoning really calls 922G1 into question, right? And it's far more inclusive, far less tailored to legitimate concerns about violence. And yet we've been told that it should be upheld. I gather, if I can try to put some words in your mouth, that you think that at least some kind of individualized determination of threat is important and would help save this kind of a restriction. Is that right?
Yes, but I also would not necessarily concede that all felon in possessions or everybody covered by G1 could be constitutionally prevented from having a gun. But the word the Supreme Court used was presumptively. Presumptive mm-hmm. assumes that there is some way to convince the court otherwise. So perhaps that means the nonviolent felons have an opportunity in an as-applied challenge. We don't know what the Supreme Court meant by that. We're all trying to predict what it meant. But it did use the word presumptively. And I see my time is up.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess.